I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Some of the best family vacations I took when I was a kid and a parent were to the country's national parks. Glacier, Arches, the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, Arcadia, Gettysburg Battlefield, the Philadelphia National Historical Park, which is right next door. Coming up, we'll get some park vacation recommendations and find out about an adventure in a remote part of Alaska. There are some 400 national parks and monuments throughout the country, and they've had to tighten their belts because of budget cuts. We asked John Garter to join us. He's Director of Budget and Appropriations at the National Parks Conservation Association, and we want to find out how the parks are doing. And John Garter, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
I'm curious, have the parks recovered from the government shutdown of the fall, sequestration, and budget cuts of the last couple of years?
Thank you for asking. Unfortunately, they haven't. There was a deal that was forged for last year and this year, and things are a little better than during sequestration, but that's not much of a bar considering sequestration was really damaging, led to 2,000 less rangers out in our national parks and a lot of closed facilities, and that really threatened local economies. Things are a little better, but far from where they need to be. If you really look at the last decade of park funding, parks haven't kept up. They're 10% below where they were. There's a huge deferred maintenance backlog that's a concern, and there just aren't the rangers out there to greet visitors and show them a good time and to care for facilities that there should be. So we're looking at the 100th anniversary of the Park Service coming up in 2016, and we're really urging decision makers to address that need.
What would adequate funding look like?
Well, adequate funding would look like certainly a robust effort to deal with the deferred maintenance backlog, which has really ballooned to nearly $12 billion over the last decade as the Park Service construction budget has been cut significantly by two-thirds, really, when you control for inflation. The president proposed a budget which seeks to provide some mandatory funding, which would require additional legislation, and that would provide over the next 3 years, as we prepare to celebrate that centennial of the park system, that would provide that mandatory funding that would make a robust effort to take a chunk out of the deferred maintenance backlog. But that requires the will of Congress in order to draft that legislation and move it forward. And so we're really urging decision makers to pursue that as the centennial gets closer. And we're urging members of the public to call their members of Congress and make sure they let them know that they're supportive and that parks should be funded.
When you talk about deferred maintenance, are we talking about rebuilding trails or repairing fences, repairing buildings that might have been damaged or affected by wear and tear over the years?
That's right, yeah. Those things that visitors see that affects their recreational experience, the roofs to the buildings, repairing bathrooms, but also things that visitors don't see, like wastewater infrastructure, drinking water infrastructure, the stuff that's underground that takes a fair amount of money to maintain, to provide, you know, for that experience that enhances, you know, that makes people comfortable, that makes them have a safe and enjoyable time. And then another big part of it is the roads backlog. That's half of that $12 billion. A lot of decaying roads, which aren't cheap to repair. They provide for visitors to, you know, of course, come to these places, and that's great for local economies. But what's needed there is a transportation reauthorization bill that provides enough for parks. That bill right now is about to run out at the end of this fiscal year, at the end of September. And unfortunately, the fees that pay for the Highway Trust Fund are running out. And so that's something Congress really needs to figure out.
And on a typical year, how many millions of visitors visit the national parks and monuments in this country?
Nearly 300 million visitors a year, and that's really, the polling shows that 9 out of 10 people have visited a national park, the vast majority of them just in the last year. So they're huge with the American public. And then, of course, 1 out of every 5 international visitors goes to our national parks. That's generating money domestically from foreign visitors, of course. That's good for local economies and good for the national economy when that money's spread out throughout the national economy. Also, those foreign visitors who come to national parks, they tend to stay longer and they're more likely to return.
Are there other ways to raise money? And you talk, I've been to a lot of these parks and enjoy them immensely, but things like entrance fees, is that a way to make money for the parks or get some revenue?
Yeah, it's a great question, and that's something we're really looking at, understanding that these are austere times, and as much as we fight the budget battles, our successes will be limited, at least for the time being. So we're looking at a number of things. Foremost, a public-private partnership. This was an idea that was started during the Bush administration. It didn't last long enough, and we were pleased to see it's part of the president's budget proposal this year, so we know that there's bipartisan support. The idea is to identify private donors who would then match the federal investment. An example would be $15 million in repairs to the Washington Monument due to the earthquake we had here in D.C. Half of that was provided by a donor. Now, that's one very wealthy donor who helped out with a big project, but these would be smaller scale projects. So that's something that we're advocating, which would be part of that legislation I mentioned. We're also looking at fees, legislation to allow the Park Service to keep those fees that they collect is about to run out, so we're urging that that be reauthorized so that they don't lose those fees, which would be an amount equivalent to the sequester. That would be very damaging. But as they do so, we are urging them to just consider where they could do pilot programs to have electronic fee collection that could save some money, to look at other things like the senior pass, which is $10 for life for anyone over 62. There's some wide agreement that that's quite a bargain. So perhaps it'd be $10 a year. That would generate some tens of millions that would be very helpful. And Americans really support that. You know, our polling shows, irrespective of political leanings, people do support funding for national parks.
When you talk about the public-private partnership, would that come with the branding rights? You know, the, you know, Glacier National Park brought to you by IKEA, for instance?
Also an excellent question. You know, the park system, as I mentioned, has been around for nearly 100 years, and these kinds of questions regularly come up. No, it would not. There is a separate effort now to consider plaques, subtle plaques in visitor centers that would recognize donors, and, you know, ideas like that that would be much more subtle but provide some additional incentive. Now, those donors themselves could certainly advertise to the public and their shareholders and so forth that they are supporting our national parks. But no, there will not be a, you know, MCI visitor center or anything like that. That's something that, you know, members of Congress and the administration are very aware would be, you know, a bad way to go.
It sounds like there are staffing shortages as well. Does that make you worry about things like vandalism or even poachers coming into national parks?
Yeah, definitely. And definitely want to emphasize to your listeners, you know, that despite some of the decay I'm talking about and the incidences of vandalism, that our national parks are very safe places to go and, of course, a really wonderful experience. But there are a lot of, you know, we regularly see incidents of vandalism and poaching. Recently in Yellowstone, 3 bison were poached. There was recently a case in California where poachers were taking huge chunks out of the California redwoods, which is really bad for the trees. It makes them vulnerable to insects and fire. Graffiti at San Antonio Missions in Texas, and also at Arches National Park, you know, graffiti carved into the rock.
Yeah.
Poaching of ginseng in the Great Smoky Mountains. And, you know, the list goes on and on. It's definitely a concern. And what's helpful there are law enforcement rangers. Certainly, they cost a little more because they require special training and a vehicle. But really, just those day-to-day seasonal rangers who are out there during the busy season, just wearing that ranger hat, they can provide that day-to-day maintenance. They can show visitors where to have hikes. They can do, you know, campfire talks for children. Really just great for the public. But also just having them out there on the ground is a deterrent for folks who, you know, intend some bad things.
Presidents have the authority to designate new parks, and I know there's a bit of a pushback coming from some members of Congress saying that they want more congressional oversight when a president, perhaps this particular president, authorizes a park or two or more. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that is a really important issue we're concerned about now. The Park Service, since they've been around, have recognized additional sites that are worthy of inclusion into the system, whether they be some of those natural areas that people know a little more or whether they are smaller historic sites. Recent efforts have been to diversify the story that the Park Service tells, that historically they haven't done a great job of interpreting our very diverse history in America. So, for example, recently they have been through presidential proclamation recognizing Harriet Tubman, who of course was important to the underground, to the whole abolition movement, to Cesar Chavez, who was not just important to the United Farm Workers, the Latinos in the West, but also to America's labor movement. That was done through an act that has been around for a long time since Teddy Roosevelt, called the Antiquities Act. It's a short bill, and it provides the president unilateral authority to recognize an area of land that is already under the management of the federal government and to turn it over to a national monument. That was used by Teddy Roosevelt to recognize Grand Canyon National Monument, later turned by Congress into a national park, and used by almost all presidents in that time to recognize a lot of places that people know well and are really important to local economies. But as you mentioned, unfortunately, it is under attack. There are members of Congress who resent the fact that the president could have that unilateral authority. The House, very disappointingly, recently passed a bill seeking to undermine that authority. We're happy, though, that it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate, and the president would never sign that. But it is an indication that, you know, we need the American public to reach out to their members of Congress to say, you know, there are places that still belong in the Park Service. They're nationally significant. They enjoy local support. And this is an important power for the president to have. It's been very successful over the years.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here. Is it too soon to say what President Obama's park legacy will be?
Well, it is, but we are very hopeful that the administration will actually propose this legislation I mentioned that would make a robust investment in to address the deferred maintenance backlog, which creates a lot of construction jobs and is good for the economy, and that would provide that partnership program. It was a good budget, but they need to follow through on it, and so we are definitely hoping that that will be his legacy in advance of this centennial, that they will do something really meaningful to recognize this 100th anniversary.
And what's the last national park that you've been to, John Garter?
I was very lucky recently to take my mom on a trip we talked about for 20 years. I took her out west to Grand Canyon and a number of other parks. She was amazed. It was a wonderful, wonderful, deeply meaning experience, and the place that blew both our minds quite a bit was Bryce Canyon in southern Utah, just otherworldly rock formations. It's like you're on another planet, and that was just awesome. I think that's my favorite for now.
Well, John Garter, thank you very much for joining us, getting our conversation started.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And he's the Director of Budget and Appropriations at the National Parks Conservation Association. Do stay with us. We have another guest waiting in the wings, and we will be talking about where to go this summer, what park to visit. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We started that conversation yesterday on our Facebook page, and we want to carry it on our airwaves today. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
Love jazz? Make a pledge of support to WHYY between April 30th and May 16th, and you'll automatically be entered in a contest to win a pair of Duke's passes to the Exit Zero International Jazz Festival in Cape May, New Jersey, which runs May 30th to June 1st. These all-access tickets include reserve seats for headline concerts, an entry into all festival club venues, along with a two-night hotel stay at the Grand Hotel. No purchase necessary to win. The winning name will be selected from all entries by a random number generator, one entry per person. Winners will be notified by email or phone and will have 24 hours to respond before a new winner is drawn. This contest is open to adults 21 years or older. Employees of WHYY are not permitted to enter. Odds of winning depend upon the total number of entries. Void where prohibited by law. Void if festival canceled for any reason. Prize package is worth $608. Winner information available through WHYY Member Services. Become a member at WHYY.org.
This is Radio Time. I'm Artie Moscoane. Summer is fast approaching. How about a camping or hiking trip to one of the country's many national parks? We asked Jonathan Dorn to join us. He's editorial director for Active Interest Media, in charge of Backpackers Magazine, Climbing Magazine, and National Parks Trips. And Jonathan Dorn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
And to our listeners, again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. If you have recommendations or questions, give us a call. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. And I have to say, Jonathan, just even putting the show together makes me want to go to a national park pronto. What's the first park you went to? Do you remember?
The first one I remember as a kid was Rocky Mountain National Park. I grew up in Ohio, and both of my parents were teachers, and so we had these wonderful month-long vacations in the summer where we would pack up the family station wagon and drive somewhere. And I remember coming across the plains and suddenly seeing these forms above the clouds, and I didn't understand, being a flatland kid, what those were until we got close enough to realize that those were the Rockies, snow-capped peaks rising above the clouds. And that was a little bit of magic that I think formed the rest of my career, which has been all about outdoor adventure and magazines about outdoor adventure.
And what's your most recent trip to a national park?
Well, oddly enough, Rocky Mountain National Park.
Oh, there you go.
I now live in Colorado. It's my backyard, and I'm actually taking my wife on a backpacking trip to Rocky this weekend for Mother's Day.
Well, how nice is that? I was talking, and I know you were listening in, talking with John Garter about the state of our national parks. And as someone who knows them well and has hiked through them and backpacked through them, do you see the kind of maintenance and even disrepair that he's been talking about, he was talking about?
I do. And although, ironically, in a way, the maintenance backlog, the lack of rangers, is a bit of a blessing in disguise for backcountry people.
I hear you.
Because in a way, it means it's even easier for us to find a little bit of solitude if there are sort of fewer services pushing people into the backcountry. And that's part of what's happened, is that the reductions in funding have also limited, in addition to some of the security issues that John talked about, some of the backcountry access. And so you've got to have a little bit more willpower and fortitude now to go on some of the more remote hikes in some of the bigger parks.
I sometimes wonder, and I'm someone that does love our national parks. I've been to as many of them as I possibly can, not as many as you, but whether we're at risk of sort of loving them to death. And there are certain parks, obviously, very popular, although I've noticed that you don't have to get very far to get away from the crowds. Have you seen that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, if you go to Yosemite Valley in mid-July or mid-August, it would appear that, you're in the equivalent of downtown Manhattan. However, fewer than 2% of all national park visitors go more than a mile from their cars in the parks. And so if you're willing to put on a pair of hiking boots and get on a trail and spend a half an hour or more walking, and of course I'd advocate for multiple days to get the true experience of the park, you'll get away from every sign of civilization in an hour or less. The backcountry of these parks is enormous. There's more true wilderness in our national park system than anybody could cover in 10 lifetimes.
Wow. Wow. And a true testament to the idea of preserving this land. Our previous guest talked about going to Bryce, and I wonder if you could make some recommendations about trips in that part of the world.
Sure. Of course, Bryce is a phenomenal park. I love that. And Arches as well, and Zion. They're part of that southern Utah road trip, you know, sort of classic road trip scene. The best time to go is either in spring or fall. It gets a little bit hot in those parks in the summer, but you also get a lot more traffic in those parks because they're so well known. I like to send people to two parks that are kind of on the periphery of that big road trip. One is Capitol Reef National Park, which is just to the west, also in southern Utah. And Capitol Reef is a little bit higher, so you know, elevation-wise, so the temperatures tend to be more moderate. It's off the beaten track, but it has all of the great Red Rock scenery and the Slot Canyons and that southwestern splendor that you get in a park like Zion with a third of the crowds. The other is Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and that's, again, easy driving distance from those other three sort of big marquee parks. And one of the sort of the secrets of the national park system is that the properties that are designated as national monuments and national forests get a lot less traffic, a lot less notice than those designated as national parks because, you know, in the outdoor adventure world, you know, the national parks are kind of the equivalent of the Kardashians or the or Brangelina. They're sort of the celebrity icons of the outdoor world.
Right.
And so, you know, People magazine might put George Clooney on the cover. You know, Backpacker magazine is going to put Yellowstone on the cover. And so when people go to do a big summer vacation that's sort of nature-oriented, those are the ones that get the first attention. Places like Grand Staircase Escalante, which is actually bigger than any of those other southern Utah parks, and has, again, all of the same wonderful scenery, slot canyons, wildlife, the desert environment, they don't get as much notice simply because of their designation. The other great thing about national monuments, as well as National Forest and Bureau of Land Management lands, which are also a federal designation, is that they tend to have fewer restrictions around where you can camp, how many days you can camp. Many of the national monuments and BLM lands, you can actually drive down a dirt road in those monuments and set up a tent or camper wherever you want to.
Wow.
And you don't have to worry about entrance fees or campground fees or, you know, guy in a big Winnebago running a generator right next to you all night long.
Sounds like you've been there, done that, yes?
Quite a bit.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jonathan Dorn, and he's editorial director for Active Interest Media in charge of Backpackers Magazine, Climbing Magazine, and National Parks Trips. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times. Summer is just around the corner and time to think about taking a vacation. And why not go to a national park or a monument or one of the national forests in this country? Any questions or comments or recommendations, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And of course, you can always send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Jonathan, is there a particular place that you think is very family centric? I mean, it seems in many ways all parks are good for families because you can enjoy them together. But are there ones you think that are particularly kid centric?
There's actually a spot very close to you, Marty, that we used to take our kids to when we lived in Allentown, and the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area is a wonderful place for families because it's a canoeing trip, and canoeing makes everything easier. You can load as much stuff as you want, including coolers and big stoves and sleeping bags, and the kids don't have to do any work. They can just sit and watch the fish. And along the Delaware Water Gap, you've got a protected zone on either side of the river, and you've got campsites literally right on the beach, and in some cases on islands in the middle of the river. Very easy to access. It's a very easy, non-technical canoe trip, so you don't have to have whitewater skills. And one of the truly amazing things about that is that even though you're within 100 miles of 20 million people in population, you're paddling through an area that's one of the foremost bald eagle rookeries in the entire world. And along a stretch of about 60 miles of river, it's not uncommon to see dozens, literally, of nesting bald eagles that have come along the sort of the eastern flyway and stop there to raise their young. Part of the reason is that the fishing habitat in the Delaware River is so strong now, it's recovered so well, that those eagles have a fantastic food source. And so that's a great way to get kids out of doors for a couple days at a time without having to do all the work of a big backpacking trip, for instance.
We have an email from Pedro. He says, my wife Pam and I took our 11-year-old last August to Glacier National Park. It was the most wonderful family time, and I remember taking our son as well to the park, and it's just beautiful. What can I say?
Glacier is one of the crown jewels, absolutely, and if you're going to Glacier, you've got to drive the Going to the Sun Road, which
yes,
is
you do.
One of the classic
traffic and all, right?
Country. And if you can get out and spend a day or two hiking, the trail you've got to do in Glacier is the Highline Trail. And almost without fail, you're guaranteed to see some of the big sort of megafauna wildlife that the West is known for. Mountain goats, bighorn sheep, grizzly bears, black bears, elk. It's one of the probably the top 10 trails in the entire national park system.
Do you have a favorite place that you like to go? Not a fair question. Not a fair question. I realize
it's
that.
It's like asking me which my favorite daughter is.
Well, of course.
if there's one place I could go back to every year, it would be I think the Olympic Coast. And there's a stretch of wild beach on the Pacific that's contained in a little tiny sliver of Olympic National Park that is just this magical place that a few backpackers know about, but it's not inundated with people, maybe until now, that is just a flat walk along a sandy wilderness beach. But every night you're camped on a headland looking out at a sunset as you know, the sun falls on ocean that for 6,000 miles, there's no people. And you can make driftwood fires and roast your marshmallows over a driftwood fire as the ocean breezes caress you. And I've had a couple of occasions to do that trip, both with friends and family. And it's one to go back to for sure.
And again, that's Jonathan Dorn, our guest on Radio Times. We're talking about where to go outside for your summer vacation. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or recommendations or comments as well? We have looks like Betty from Center City, Philadelphia, joining us. Betty, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I was listening to your show this morning, and I was thinking of a wonderful trip I took with my nephew, who was 9 at the time, and our first stop was the Grand Tetons, and it was a kids' trip, an intergenerational trip, I should say, and the kids absolutely revolted when we got to the hotel because there wasn't TV in the hotel, and the tour director said, "This is your TV, the land is your TV," and those children spent hours just looking at the land, looking for moose. And it was just magical. So I would recommend that to anybody, to take their kids to any national park, because it is always magical.
Well, Betty, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jonathan, does that story sound familiar to you?
It sure does, and we joke that there's about a 3-day transition period with kids where for the first 2 days, you know, they tend to whine and wonder where their PlayStations are, and then something clicks in, and next thing you know, they're playing in the dirt, or like Betty, you know, her experience, they're looking at the scenery in a different way. And so you got to give it a little bit of time, but the kids will come around for sure.
Well, and I like the idea of intergenerational trips to the parks as well. It's always good to get the generations together, but to do it in a park seems to open up all sorts of possibilities.
It doesn't. You know, I think one of the things that all of us who are interested in parks are really looking at the centennial for, and John sort of briefly touched on this in the previous segment, is how we can use the centennial as an opportunity both to really expand the audience for parks, both in terms of age and sort of that multi-generational effect, but also in terms of diversity. And the population in our country has changed pretty significantly since we started protecting parks 100 some years ago, but the diversity of the population going into the parks has not changed at the same rate. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the really important things, again, to John's point, about building more of a enthusiast-based and a better sort of grassroots political force in favor of parks is how can we use the centennial to really expand the diversity of the population that cares about parks and visits parks. And one of the really smart things that the National Park Service has done over the last several years to try to introduce new people and increase participation in the parks is create days where they don't charge entrance fees. And this year, we've already had a couple of those, but there are three more coming up where you can get into any national park for free. And so in the case of Rocky Mountain National Park in my backyard, you would normally pay, you know, $10 to walk in or $60 for an annual pass. Those are waived this summer on August 25th, September 27th, and then Veterans Day, November 11th. And the park has really, I think, done a smart thing with that, and we've seen big spikes in visitation on those weekends.
Have you ever hiked the Appalachian Trail? I've interviewed people who have either the whole darn thing or parts of it.
I've hiked most of it in sections, you know, being on a magazine schedule.
Yes,
I've got to be back in the office once a month, but I've done about half of the total mileage.
And what was that like for you?
It's a magical experience in a different way than, say, a glacier, where, you know, in glacier you're going for full solitude and big wildlife and some of that classic John Muir stuff. The Appalachian Trail is more interesting. It's almost a cultural experience, if you will, because there's a real community of people who travel the trail, both the thru-hikers who start in Georgia and go for 6 months and wind up in Maine, but also people who are coming from the communities that border the trail. And along the 3,000 miles of Appalachian Trail, there's more than 100 million people living within 100 miles of either side of it. And so I look at the Appalachian Trail as a way to be walking with and meeting fellow hikers and hearing their stories and having more of a almost an outdoor community experience, outdoor village experience, than I would be looking to have in a sort of a bigger Western wilder park.
And we're almost up on a break here. We have a tweet from Feldy. I've been to several, but two of my all-time favorites are Joshua Tree and Sawtooth National Forest. Any comments on that, Jonathan?
Sawtooth is one of the true hidden gems of this country. It is got incredible mountains. Nobody gets back there. It's a year-round paradise, really. I've been ski touring there in the winter. It's got fabulous snow, and in the summer, fabulous wildlife.
Well, let's take that short break. And again, that's Jonathan Dorn. He's editorial director for Active Interest Magazine, in charge of Backpackers Magazine, Climbing Magazine, and National Parks Trips. We have another guest waiting in the wings, and he'll be talking about some adventures he had in a very remote park, or I guess it's a national monument in Alaska. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Millions of people visit national parks and monuments every year. They are popular tourist destinations that can lead to big crowds and big traffic jams. Our guest, Christopher Solomon, prefers to get away from all of that. He trekked through Aniakchak National Monument in a remote part of Alaska and wrote about it in Outside Magazine. And Christopher Solomon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So why Aniakchak?
You know, I have a little bit of a personal problem. I guess I'm just sort of obsessed with the blank spots on the map. And for about 10 years, I've wondered about this place ever since I came across it. What is this place at the bottom of the list that never gets any visitors? And the more I looked into it, the more I realized it's the best place you've never heard of.
And by no visitors, you mean something like, you know, 10 or 15 a year or something like that?
Yeah. So let me, just as an example, when I was doing the homework for the piece, Great Smoky Mountains National Park gets roughly 9.7 million visitors coming through the gates a year, or, you know, roughly 19 a minute. And the year before I went to Aniakchak, last year, Aniakchak got roughly 19 all year. And maybe 100 or so last year. But the numbers are really rough because there's no entrance gate. There's almost no way to count them.
Well, as you say, this is a place that's the size of Vermont, about 3,000 people who live there. Is there a way? I've seen some of your photos. In fact, we put them on our homepage. Can you describe this national monument to our listeners?
Yeah, let me set the scene briefly because, you know, it's almost hard to place. So, you know, Alaska, of course, just a mammoth state. And maybe, you know, people will think of the Aleutian Islands, that big tail of the United States that kind of wags westward at Russia. And the stub of that tail is this thing called the Alaska Peninsula. And the Alaska Peninsula is enormous. It's the size of Vermont and has 3,000 people in the whole nearly roadless peninsula. And in the middle of that peninsula, roughly, is Aniakchak, and it's 450 miles southwest of Anchorage. And the reason it gets no visitors, well, there are many, but, you know, there are no roads that reach there, so the Winnebagoes can't get there. It's got just horrific weather. It's sort of wedged between the Bering Sea on one side and the Pacific on the other, and so it's just pummeled by storms. An outfitter said to me, you know, this basically is where the weather is made for the rest of the country, which is actually true. The storms kind of organize themselves up here and then barrel down over Canada and the United States. And then to add to that, it's just, there's almost no trails up there. There are no signs. There are no park rangers, to be sure. And then it's also home to one of the largest concentrations of the biggest brown bears on Earth. So it's inhospitable country.
And the perfect place for you to go for an adventure. How close to the bears did you get?
It's funny about bears. You don't want to see them, but then when you don't see them for a while, you want to see them, but you want to see them kind of not going through your food bag. So we didn't see them for several days, and we started to get kind of disappointed. And then we ended up seeing 19 in 24 hours.
Wow. And they really are huge, yes?
Yeah. And, you know, luckily I did see them, you know, from far away. We practiced all the bear appropriate procedures, but we usually saw them we saw almost all of them once we got down to the Pacific side of the peninsula. We crossed the peninsula, and they were all coming down because to the water with their cubs, usually these mothers, because they were getting ready to teach them how to fish for salmon. It was that time of the late summer.
Jonathan Dorn, let me get you back in on the conversation. I'm assuming, do you know about Aniakchak?
I do. I haven't had the good fortune to be there, but I've had numerous trips in Alaska and sort of got a little bit of chills when Chris was describing the salmon spawning, because I've been in that type of environment, sort of shoulder to shoulder with grizzlies as well.
One of the things that you wrote in your piece in Outside Magazine, Christopher, is the colors are always brighter if the place draws a little blood first. The idea that, you know, the world looks a little better when you, what, have to suffer just a bit?
Yeah, this is maybe just a personal preference. But there's a wonderful, famous mountaineer here in the Pacific Northwest named Fred Becky, who's still alive, and he's climbed everything first. And he has this wonderful quote in a book he wrote called Challenge of the North Cascades, which is my favorite national park up here in Washington State. And I think the quotation is, beauty is paid for partly in the currency of suffering. You know, and I think the idea, you know, is basically things are better when you have to earn them. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And the arduousness of our trip up there and the effort it took to get there made the beauty, which was already over the top, and we ended up having really good weather for much of the time, it made the fruit that much sweeter, I guess.
Do you subscribe to that policy, Jonathan Dorn?
Yeah, and you know, there's some physiological basis for that. One of the things that happens in your brain as it's deprived of the sort of onslaught of stimuli from TV and car horns and lights and flashing neon is that your brain actually gets a little bit more active. And one of the things that as backpackers we expect to happen on longer trips is that our dreams become more vivid.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Our brains go into this different mode where they're both receiving more and they're producing more.
So the brain's sort of actively seeking out some kind of stimulation, but without cell phones and all the other stuff that we have in our urban environments.
Yeah, there's some kind of, you know, shell that protects us in civilization that gets removed and allows us to, you know, both, you know, metaphorically but also physiologically engage in a deeper way with the wilderness experience when we're out there.
And Christopher, I'm just curious about what it's, and we're on the radio here, but, you know, what it sounds like at Aniak Tech.
That's a really good question. I mean, I think I should step back a little bit. I feel like I've been remiss and haven't told readers what exactly they'll find there. The centerpiece of the monument is this blown-out volcano. And so 3,500 years ago, when the Egyptians were kind of ruling things in the Mediterranean, this 7,000-foot volcano blew up with a force of like 10,000 nuclear bombs. And it one of the larger eruptions we've had that we know of on Earth. And it then collapsed on itself and basically created this giant crater ring that could swallow the island of Manhattan now. And it later filled with water, then drained. And so now inside, if you backpack into it, as we did, you drop into this lost world, kind of, where it's like a moonscape inside that's still trying to recover from the 1931 eruption, which was the last kind of burp of this area. And it's when you get inside, we had tremendous winds off the Bering Sea as we tried to drop over the crater lip, and it just kind of tossed us over the top. And then you get inside, and it was perfectly silent.
Wow.
And there were, you know, just a little caribou running by, and you know, and but no. No evidence of man. I think we saw one boot print, and God knows where that came from. And almost complete silence. And but it can rage in there. People told us stories about the Coast Guard having to come in and pluck people out of there when their tents got shredded in hurricane force winds. But we had about 3 days of complete. About 2 days in there of complete silence, where the only thing you'd kind of see but wouldn't really hear sound of is the big summer fogs off the Bering Sea would pour up onto the lip of this massive crater and then dive over while you're inside this gopher hole, and they would just shred in what one early observer called these cloud Niagaras. And so you'd just be standing watching this silent waterfall of clouds above 2,000 feet above you, going on all day long. It was just kind of like a silent nature film. It was just spectacular.
And did you have wild dreams, as Jonathan Dorn was talking about?
You know, if I did, I don't remember them. I was so tired. We were carrying 65-pound packs because we were out for 10 days, and we carried these small inflatable kayaks that are the real rage in Alaska, called pack rafts, that allow for you to they're about the size of a tent, but with all their accoutrements, can be about 16 pounds to let us go raft down the river to go to the Pacific. And so the packs were so heavy that we were exhausted all the time.
Let me reintroduce the two of you, and that's Christopher Solomon. He's a freelance writer. He writes often about the outdoors, and his article Surviving Aniakchak National Monument appears in the May issue of Outside Magazine. Jonathan Dorn, also with us, editorial director for Active Interest Media, in charge of Backpackers Magazine, Climbing Magazine, and National Park Trips. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times with any ideas, recommendations, or stories. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jonathan, if I can go back to you, and just in terms of sort of not the kind of hiking or trip that Christopher was talking about, but just sort of basic backpacking ideas for people that maybe even for the first time they're going to take a backpacking trip, what should they be thinking about or planning for?
Well, the first thing I should say, since we're talking about national parks, is when to go. And you know, the parks tend to be really pretty busy between roughly July 1st and August 15th. So if you can plan your trip around that, and actually the real sweet spot, the sort of the magic window, is late August through September. Kids are back in school,
right.
You know, bugs are gone, and weather's pretty settled. You tend to have the parks and the trails to yourself. And oftentimes you see a lot more wildlife because they're starting their pre-winter foraging for hibernation. And you have changing leaves and beautiful colors in the parks. Apart from that, it's not a high hurdle to get into backpacking. Go into an REI or any outdoor retail store near you, and without fail, the person that is going to help you on the show floor is there because they're passionate about backpacking and are going to want to share the how-to with you. They don't make enough money to do it if they weren't.
I got you.
weren't passionate about it. Planning ahead, if you're going to a national park, does make a lot of sense. In some places that are more high profile, like Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. there is a permit system for which, in the high season, you really need to be applying for the permit online as much as 6 months in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So start thinking ahead, you know, if you're targeting one of those bigger places. If you don't have that kind of time, then, you know, look on the map. You know, I've got the same addiction that Chris does to look at maps and wonder, you know, sort of where next. And most of the big national parks have national forest or national monument lands right next to them that see a fraction of the crowd. So Yosemite, for instance, gets absolutely inundated with people in the valley in the summer. But just to the south of that, Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park has the giant trees, the wonderful light that drew Ansel Adams to photograph there, but a lot fewer people on the trails and in the campgrounds. Similarly, right to the other side of Yosemite, the Ansel Adams Wilderness Area is one of the most pristine, little visited wilderness areas in the entire country. So if you're willing to just sort of shift your gaze a little bit to the right or a little bit to the left, you can often find places that have very easy access, fewer people, fewer restrictions, and all the same wilderness qualities.
Let me get Tom from Berks County to join us at Radio Times. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm just calling to talk about an experience that I had with national parks. When I was in high school, I never really visited a national park, or, you know, I've only learned about it or saw it or read about it in books or saw stuff on TV. And 2 days after I graduated from high school, I was on a plane. I was going out to Rocky Mountain National Park to work for the summer. And that experience had a really profound impact on my life and really shaped who I am today. And I work in the environmental field. And I'm just wondering, you know, if more people had that experience, just seeing a national park or being there or seeing the open space or the wild aspects of these parks, if the guest thinks that, you know, that might impact the environmental issues that we're trying to face in this country and throughout the world.
Well, Tom,
just something simple like that.
Sure. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have just a minute before we have to end the discussion. And Christopher Solomon, if I can toss that to you for a quick response.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's not my thought to, you know, to say, you know, you can't care about what you don't know.
Right. How about for you, Jonathan Dorn?
Well, I think about my senator, you know, Mark Udall from Colorado, who grew up in the outdoors and for 10 years was the director of Outward Bound, and he is one of the foremost champions for public lands in this country. And his example and everybody who's been through a summer with the Student Conservation Association or done a National Outdoor Leadership School class become profound advocates for environmental issues.
Well, you both have made us want to just run out the door and go somewhere, go outside. Jonathan Dorn, thank you very much for joining us today, Radio Times.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's editorial director for Active Interest Media. And Christopher Solomon, thank you very much as well.
Oh, my pleasure. This is fun.
It's fun for us as well. And you can read his article, Surviving Aniakchak National Monument, in the May issue of Outside Magazine. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. In fact, we posted some of Christopher's photos from Aniakchak on our homepage, so do check them out. They're quite extraordinary. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.